beautiful sunny day today. We're going to start off, colleagues, with a presentation by Norm Eder from the Manufacturing 21 Coalition. So, Mr. Eder, welcome and thank you for taking the time to give us a synopsis of the good work the coalition's been doing.
Thank you very much. Let me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first let me tell you, I don't mean to croak at you, but I've been about 3 days without a voice. I've finally gotten it back a little bit today. I'll do my best, and Senator Deckert, who is my senator, and who I remember when he was about three, I think, came and sat and watched a football game with my sons, who are about just slightly younger than he is. So.
Yeah, 7 or 8 years ago.
At least seven or eight years ago. Yeah, I think he was three.
Those are the kind of stories legislators love to hear.
Yeah. Well, we understand that. And,
I think it was the Ducks.
So we'll understand. You can pace yourself. So.
Well, I have water.
Just identify yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Norman Eder, and I'm executive director of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition. The coalition was formed two years ago, and I'm pleased to say that it took us a better part of 2 years to figure out we needed to do more than just form up. So on Friday, this past Friday, we formally incorporated as an organization, and we will be a 501c6 organization. We are an independent, private sector-led, statewide advocate for manufacturing. And our membership includes large and small companies. You have a list of our members and our management team in front of you, as well as our advisory board. Organized labor, we're pleased to be working with AFL-CIO, public and private economic development organizations, regional workforce development boards, and 2- and 4-year higher education institutions. What is remarkable about, I think, what the business leaders have done is to understand that having a business-led group is important only so far as it goes, that it's really important, though, that you have an enduring relationship with all of your partners who you rely upon for services. And as we continue to expand around the state, which is something we've done and certainly paid attention to in the last few months, just Friday, the Oregon Bridge Partnership, as you all know, as Senator Starr knows him quite well, is responsible for the building, rebuilding and building bridges across the state. The infrastructure industry have become members as well as Umpqua Community College. And our mission is to ensure that Oregon has a highly skilled and motivated workforce and a steady stream of applied innovations to support the needs of globally competitive manufacturing companies. That's a mouthful, and you may wonder why we ought to care about that. And give you just a pretty simple explanation. Manufacturing accounts in Oregon for one of every five jobs, and this makes it pretty darn important. But then when you think about what those jobs mean to our communities, is that a huge percentage of those jobs are the state's backbone of state's family wage jobs. When you take manufacturing and construction and you combine them, well into the 70th percentile of all the family wage jobs lie within those two industries. So these two related industries in terms of needing workforce and innovation are very, very important to our economy. And I've given you, and I won't go through the data, but I posed Lori Warner of the Oregon Employment Department has been just an extraordinary partner, and I want to say also Mike Salzgiver from the Department of Economic and Community Development also has been a partner of our coalition. I pose the question, so tell me how our industry manufacturers relate to other industries economically. And so this data is data that the gnomes inside the department generated for me a few weeks back to show you the relationship between growth in the manufacturing cluster and additional dollars in terms of output and how that reverberates through the economy in terms of other sectors of the economy, all of which, of course, are germane to this committee. So I think that gives you a good sense of why it's so important. The hallmark of the organization that we've built and frankly are continuing to build is a hands-on commitment to becoming knowledgeable and involved with those organizations, public and private, who provide the services that our companies depend upon for skilled workforce and innovation. And this is a really important point that I want to make. As Senator Deckert knows, I've been in this business for quite a while. And over many years, I've watched many business organizations speak about problems, speak about their challenges in workforce training, education, innovation, technology transfer. The list goes on and on. Frankly, without ever really understanding how those systems out there, how those institutions out there that they rely upon really work. And so when I used to be in the higher education business, I sometimes used to remind my business friends that, you know, you may ask us to do X, Y, or Z, but we really weren't created to do X, Y, or Z. That's not within our structures, not within us. So you're really, your complaints are misplaced. Instead, let's figure out how we get you what you need within the structure of what we can actually do, within the limitations of our institutions as set up as businesses, after all. And I think Manufacturing 21 understands that very well. And so we've tried to understand the system as well, and how it works, and how we, in fact, can roll up our sleeves and help it help us. So let me paint the problem for you, if I can, for just a moment. The companies that are part of the coalition, and frankly, every employer in the state and many employers across the country, face severe shortages of skilled labor. The shortage will only worsen as those of us, and with the exception of Senator Deckert up there, who are of the baby boom generation, retire. I just last week was speaking to, he's my senator. I can talk to him about these important issues. Just last week, I was speaking to somebody at Portland General Electric, and they noted to me that they have a 20-person line crew that serves Clackamas County, and in the last year, eight of those people have either retired or will retire within the next few months. That's going on across industry in Oregon. The highest skilled, most experienced employees are retiring. So the labor shortage just gets worse. It doesn't get better. And all you, and then when you look at the other end of it, you say, well, let's just launch programs. Excuse me. It turns out that the pipeline for these skilled jobs is largely empty. Ask Portland Community College how many young students they have enrolled in their skill-based education programs. Pat Kraft is the fellow you ought to give a call to. And the answer he'll give you is, well, one or two maybe. The rest of them are incumbent workers, people between jobs looking for retraining, but not new people to the workforce. Ask the FL-CIO how much trouble they have getting people into their apprenticeships programs. They'll tell you a lot. Ask Umpqua Community College, fresh on my mind because I spoke to them last week, how many people it attracted to an industry design and paid for program for wood products training. The answer is 5 or 6. The program didn't fly because they couldn't find anybody. So pipeline is a critical issue. And the people who do find their way to the door of Oregon manufacturers, often lack both the hard and soft skills needed for employment, or at least to succeed. And the employers and labor organizations grapple every single day with the consequences of drug use and family problems. All the problems that appear at the schools, appear in our society, appear at the workplace. Our academic research institutions, while they do many things very well, one of the things they have not done as well as perhaps we'd like to see them do is the kind of applied research that our companies need. There's a long story behind this. I won't bore you today with how over 50 years the applied research part of our universities has declined, but in fact it has. It isn't Oregon's fault. It isn't our university's fault. There's a larger system out there, but it's something that we ought to be addressing. And this is why the members of Manufacturing 21 Coalition have come together, and for the past 2 years have participated in a major effort led by Governor Kulongowski to develop statewide solutions to our workforce challenges, and with Oregon Inc. To address our applied innovation needs. We very strongly support the recommendations of these initiatives, and this includes the Cluster Development Fund, the Skill Up Oregon funds proposed by the governor, and we're especially pleased, I want to emphasize this because I'm not sure that it was necessarily envisioned at the beginning of when Oregon Inc. began their work, but we're especially pleased by the recommendations of the Oregon Innovation Council that listened very carefully to our industry when we came forward and when we spoke about the needs of an existing industry that employs a lot of Oregonians today for innovation. And so we're very pleased that they included us and our industry in Oregon's innovation plan and made provision in the recommendations to the governor for some for funding to begin addressing some of the applied innovation needs of our industry. We also have we've been, as a coalition, very active in D.C., and we managed to bring home, will bring home, we haven't gotten it yet, $2.5 million from the Defense Department to help augment workforce training and innovation in Oregon. And this is well connected, integrated with what we asked the Innovation Council to do and what we've been talking to the governor about. We know that it's critical that industry roll up its sleeves and be active partners. It's not enough just to define problems. It's not enough just to talk about problems. You got to do something about them. Our members are organizing and paying for the third annual Northwest Center or Northwest Career Expo this coming May. Last year, this event attracted 4,000 youth from the Portland area, high school students and teachers. This year, we expect 5,000, and I keep suggesting we might have 6, but we'll see. And we'll spend nearly $100,000 of private money on this effort. And I want to underscore this effort for another reason. A few moments ago, I made the comment that it's important that we know how systems work. Well, we figured out that unless we hired buses and paid for teacher release time, our expo would never attract students or teachers. So we did. That's where that $100,000 or so goes to, is to hire, to pay for buses and teacher substitute time so that we can bring the students to the convention center in Portland. And there are a variety of other activities that the coalition has sponsored that we think are providing leadership and an example for the way in which industry can become involved with institutions in getting the results that we all need. Along the way, we've learned some valuable lessons. So lessons learned are always important. First, when people talk about workforce and workforce development, they always attach the word system. Well, we don't have a workforce development delivery system in the state. Instead, what we have are a collection of loosely aligned agencies, organizations, and institutions who do their best. They do their best with limited funding, with constrained mandates, and separated by mission and geography to perform for employers and perform for those people they're training. But it's not really a system. The word system is a misnomer. We're very good at talking about problems, institutions and budgets. There'll be a lot of that over the next 4 or 5 months. But we're not really nearly as good or facile when it comes to talking about solutions. There are no simple or quick solutions to the problems that we're here to talk about today. These are things that are generational in nature. There's no single magic bullet. There's no one program. There's no one thing you can do. But nonetheless, we need to do something. But remember, it isn't going to be one thing. It isn't going to be one thing one time. And the last lesson that I can tell you our business members have learned is that if you fail to appreciate all of the above, we're never going to get past the on-deck circle, or maybe we're never going to get out of the dugout. So where does that bring us as a coalition? That's a baseball thing, yeah.
That was just mentioned to me.
Okay. Just want to make sure that you're following that
right
carefully.
Over my
Gary made me do it. The coalition posed a question to itself about 3 months ago, and so I'm delighted to be here because the question involved you. The question we posed to ourselves was, So when the legislature calls itself into session, and it has an avalanche of people talking to it about workforce and innovation, how can we help the legislature think about how to manage, how to shape their own thinking about this problem? In a sense, a template that you can develop ideas through to be able to take action with. So here is an 8-point template and our calls to action that we would ask you to consider and then to begin to act upon during this session. First and foremost, fill the human capital pipeline. This is the biggest challenge that we face. We have lots of programs, we just don't have people. And at the same time, we have lots of people who are barely getting through high school, who are given choices. You can be a rocket scientist or you can work at McDonald's, and never told that they can go to work for Precision Cast Parts or Gunderson or Medford Manufacturing or you name it. And so we need to launch a major initiative to show young people and those who influence them that there are career choices, and we need to have business involved and a business-led voice in doing that. We need to create a demand-driven delivery system that's shaped by strong state policies implemented by local private sector leadership. These are the local regional boards around the state who have business-led boards who are a huge resource for this state. And it needs to be guided by common data collection. And so I won't bore you with the data collection part, except that it's really important. We barely know what our trends are. Every agency, every organization collects data differently. We miss huge portions of people. We don't know a lot. And we need to pull that together in one place. And the good news is we have a system for doing that. We just haven't fully implemented it. The Employment Division's iMatch system is a very powerful system. They currently have 1 million people registered in that. Well, maybe we ought to have 2.5 million people, and we ought to be using it to guide our policies and share data across institutional boundaries, something we don't yet do, and it's something that will guide our investments for the future. We need to reinvent skills-based education. This is one where, I tell you, we think too much about the past and not the future. We think about skills-based education as it used to be in every high school and in every school district, and every community college. Much of those programs have atrophied. They don't exist anymore. They're just hanging on to the degree that they're even there. So we need to reinvent how we do that. And I wish I could tell you how to do that. We have some ideas, but frankly, I'd say this is one that would be well worth some time during an interim in looking at and asking a group of legislators to come back with a set of real proposals for how we might do that, to share resources across geographic and across institutional boundaries. We need to create new training tools for high school and college faculty, counselors, and as well as industry clusters to ensure connectivity to changing industry needs. This is another element. We have people in our schools, in our public schools, in our community colleges and our universities who are all wanting to do the right thing. Sometimes they don't have the right curriculum tools. And so if you're going to seek to train the next generation of skilled labor, from the welder to the rocket scientist, I think we need to look at the people that are training them, people that are influencing them. And so new curriculum tools would be very, very helpful. And, again, that would be an area that I would urge you to explore and to think about during this session. Expand high-performance learning networks to transform industry and learning. This is one that we can say we're already beginning to do it. The Northwest High Performance Enterprise Consortium is a group of companies, I think they're about 70, 80 strong, who have been teaching themselves about lean and high performance and how to use high performance tools. And the governor and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board stepped in with a $500,000 grant to implement to begin to help create other an expansion of the lean manufacturing programs in the state. And so that's one where we could almost put a check mark there and say, you know, we're doing that right now. We're doing it today, and we think that's great. We want to restore the ethic of applied learning to and research to higher education. I already spoke about to this, but clearly we would like to see even more meaningful connectivity between industry and our universities. And it's a tough thing to do, but it's something of, I think you have to look at incentives and how we incent the universities and faculty members and industry to work together. And I would point you to the Oregon Metals Initiative, a long-standing program that actually has a pretty darn good incentive. It says that if you're a university faculty member and you have an idea about research for the metals sector, and you take it to a company, and the company says it's willing to put money on the table to pay for that research, the state will pay for part of it too. That's a pretty good incentive. Let's the work follow. And finally, a very important one is we'd like to see us implement a private sector evaluation model to assure provider accountability and industry satisfaction. Right now, accountability in this state, and frankly most states in this whole area, is largely driven by a need to become accountable to the funding sources. Funding sources are mostly interested in whether or not you've spent their money in the way they want you to spend it. Did you meet their accounting guidelines? Not necessarily in the outcome. We think that it's important that outcomes be measured. And ultimately, the customer for the workforce training and our innovation systems are industry and those people who are being trained. And we ought to ask them, and if they're satisfied with what they got, and we ought to guide our policies by whether or not, by the rankings that they give us. That's our 8-point template. We think that if you were to use this, you could come up with a pretty good workforce package for the session. It would be a package that would not solve all the problems, and it would only look forward to the next session when we would take some more steps. We would urge you to be careful, deliberate, and specific about what you would ask all of the organizations, including Manufacturing 21, to do after you leave. Our purpose is to see action. We've had meetings. I can tell you, my members have been to more meetings than you'd almost think that people didn't run companies anymore, that they just went to meetings. We think it's time to act. And again, these 8 points I think is a template for that kind of action. We think there are lots of good ideas out there. We're not prescriptive. We think that there are lots of people who would come forward, and if you say, well, we want to reinvent skills-based education, we think you'd find some good ideas. We urge you to choose some of them and begin. And that's our message. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Eager. It is certainly a major concern of this legislature in terms of moving into those areas in which we see a real demand for workforce and also the quality of jobs, but also what it does for our economy. And I know in our education committees, I'm sure you're probably aware that vocational ed has been elevated to an area of high importance because of the same theme. I found it very interesting last summer in particular when I'm sure all my colleagues have gone to a number of the apprenticeship type programs and visited some of the facilities where these types of skills are taught. But I was in one of those industry facilities last summer and talking to a group of maybe 14 or 15 individuals there who, and this was electrical, the IBEW facility down Airport Way, with a very, very rigorous 5-year program, but not learning a job, but learning a career, which is, a significant difference. But it was very interesting talking to some of those folks, and because I asked them about their ages were like 23 to 37, about how they got involved with the program, what was their interest level. And one of the things that really stood out almost universally was that none of those individuals learned or knew about the program in high school. No one ever told them about that. 3 of the individuals were college graduates. And they wanted to go to college, but at the end of college, they really didn't have a career. And then they learned about this and said, I would have gone right to this program had my counselor had any idea that you existed. So they went off to college and got a degree, but didn't really have a career path. And I think that really, at least to me, kind of illuminated the fact that for all good intentions, and since you came from that side of the fence as well, you know, we have kind of had blinders on and not allowing people to know about the opportunities that are available. And once that happens, we lose programs on the high school level. And after that, we lose the any type of relationship between these types of programs having some kind of an organized system. And now I think we're just starting to realize that these are not jobs that don't come without education. It requires a lot of education. It's just a different type of education, and it's very, very critical for our economy that we have the workforce to be able to meet those needs. So I really appreciate your organization coming together to help further, that message. Questions? Senator Montes Anderson.
Well, more a comment, because I firmly believe that this K through 12, particularly the high schools and community colleges, in an area or a region need to start working together and looking at the needs in their own local areas. And I take the Center for Advanced Learning in Gresham as an example, where they chose manufacturing, and it's a charter school and it draws students from Reynolds, Centennial, Corbett, Gresham, Barlow, and not sure David Douglas is included. But again, there's a waiting list of kids to get into that, and it's proven to be very successful, and I'm looking forward to the data, and they're tracking these students to see then what kind of jobs they did go into after they've been educated. But I agree with all your points. It's hard for me to see a direction that the legislature can really pick up and grab and pass along when we really need to have our community colleges and our industry and businesses working together to come up with a plan for at least their regions. Just a comment.
Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Eder, for being here today. Just a couple of questions. I was struck by, I guess, the sentence on the bottom of the second page of your testimony, not so much about that people who make their way to the front door lack the hard and soft skills, but that employers and labor organizations are grappling with the consequences of drug use. And as you completed your testimony, you talk about a lot of the other issues, but you don't talk about dealing with that particular problem. Is that something that the coalition is hoping will go away, or that someone else is going to deal with, or we're just going to talk a little bit about how your members are dealing with that particular issue as well?
So it isn't enough just to say we hope it goes away? Okay. It's a huge issue. You speak to any employer, especially employers that that I represent, whose jobs often have a degree of danger to them. Working around machinery is, you need to be clean and sober. And every employer will tell you that a huge percentage of the people that they see and that will come through their door are going to have some drug problems, and they have them at the workplace, and they have them. So this is a big deal. The coalition we're sponsoring for our members, and others will be there, I'm sure, but for manufacturers this spring, drug-free workforce training program that is something that's been put together by the Oregon Nurses Association. So we're attempting to continue to educate ourselves about employment policies, management issues, all of those things. And there's a wide degree of sophistication, a range of sophistication from one company to the next. As you know, the labor movement is very aware of this issue and has also developed. And in where organized labor is a presence with our companies work very closely with organized labor in terms of, again, workplace training, workplace communications with regard to drugs. By the time somebody gets their hand in a piece of machinery, it's too late, and our companies are very aware of it. Do we have any solution? Unfortunately, we don't have a ready one because it's a big, big problem.
follow up, Mr. Chair. Just in a way of a personal anecdote, I have a very good friend that runs a small construction company, and he was dealing with this very problem of applicants coming in the door and not being drug free. And he, very small company, really didn't have the means to drug test everybody. And so in his application or his advertisement, he would just mention that drug testing would occur, even though he really wasn't going to occur, and he saw a significant drop-off in applicants. Mm-hmm. So that's just an anecdotal story about my own personal relationship, experience. Question two about the $2.5 million you got in the federal mm-hmm. appropriation. Who's the recipient of those funds, and how are they going to be spent?
Well, I happen to know that because I just on this weekend sent off the proposal to the Defense Department. This was a partnership between Manufacturing 21, the Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition, and the governor's office. There are three components to the package, in no particular importance of level of importance, but there are three of them. The first one is an R&D component, and the package is roughly divided up into thirds, and there'll be a tax we'll have to pay to the Defense Department, so we won't actually get $2.5 million when all is said and done, because they always apply tax. But the first piece of it will be for R&D, applied R&D, just the sort of thing actually that complements what we went to the Innovation Council about, because we were working on the two on the same time. It's not the same stuff. The work will be done at Portland State and with a relationship with OIT. Again, reflecting the membership of the coalition. The second piece is for the Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition. Senator Metzger, I think you're probably very aware of that, because there are a lot of Clackamas County companies who are part of that organization. They are a group of companies, I think there are 50 or 60 companies now, who are engaged in trying to educate themselves to become better providers of defense products to defense customers, to the Defense Department. And so a part of the money will be used to assist them to do that. Most of these are small companies. And then the third piece of it is for workforce development. Again, and this will be targeted to companies who are doing defense work. You have to remember the source of the money was DOD. And so that third piece of it will be for incumbent workers and high performance. And I guess what I would point out, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, is that you should, if you heard in those priorities, the same priorities that I spoke about in my testimony, the same priorities, Senator Deckert, that we brought before the Innovation Council, I hope what you'll see is an organization that has thought through the system and thought through funding sources and funding opportunities and how we build capacity, how we build new capacity in the state in workforce and innovation to help manufacturers. And so we've pulled federal levers, we're pulling state levers, we're also pulling private company levers. As you well know, a lot of money has been spent by the coalition in supporting planning and development of many of its activities.
Follow up, sure. The $2.5 million. Then a check was written to.
Oh, check hasn't been written yet.
but where? What is the? Is it going to the state of Oregon or?
Yeah, it goes. It will go to this initial first protocol is state of Oregon, Oregon Economic Development and Community Development.
So that's the agent.
That's the agent. That's who we signed up to roughly a year ago now, when we were writing this proposal to the congressional delegation. I think actually I called up Mike Salzgiver and said, if we got some money and we sent it your way, would you hold on to it for just a short period of time? And then from there it'll get managed according to the contract that we agreed to with the Defense Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Other questions?
Well, Friday I had the privilege to be out at one of your Northwest Defense Coalition members, Oregon Iron.
Yes.
Where you may have seen in the paper they unveiled that they will be making the very first streetcar to be made in the United States, right in Clackamas. And I mean, just another example of the fact that manufacturing, which maybe a number of years ago, a lot of people thought was dead, really is alive and well if we just understand what those where those niches are, and that our own companies can be very successful. And of course, the workforce needed for those is extremely important. And good-paying jobs and the opportunities are there. And you know, that is actually a growing sector. And as you mentioned, in Clackamas in particular, a lot of small companies are on the verge of doing big things. And we need to be part of that and make sure that the students that we have in our schools in Oregon are aware of these opportunities. And should they desire to have those skills to participate, we want to make sure, as you mentioned, there is some kind of continuum of putting these services and programs together. So thank you so much. We look very much forward to working with you and appreciate the good efforts you have done so far.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll close the informational hearing. We have two bills on the docket today. We had mentioned the other day that we wanted to see a few more of our seats filled up, so we knew if we did something on utilities, we could do that. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 85, and let me see how I should best do this. Let's start with Chairman Beyer from the Oregon Public Utility Commission, since it's your bill, to give us an introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I have with me Jerry Murray, who is our chief safety engineer and has to deal with these pole attachment issues on a day-to-day basis. Oregon law requires that utilities be allowed to attach to utility poles owned by other utilities. This assumes that the attachments can be done safely and that the pole owner will be compensated fairly for use by the attachee. What Senate Bill 85 is intended to correct is an inequity in the utility pole attachment regulations. Specifically, that government entities or public bodies are exempt from the attachment regulations requirements by virtue of just being a public body. This exemption currently applies regardless of the business role of the public body. This inequity is best demonstrated by the parties to a recent dispute that was brought before the commission. The dispute involved Verizon, who is a licensee under our rules, and Central Lincoln Public Utility District. Because the PUD, which by definition and statute is a government, they're not subject to the attachment regulations and therefore are not a licensee. The pole attachment rules and all sanctions provisions for the enforcement of these rules in our state apply to licensees, but not to public bodies. In addition, because public bodies are not licensees, they are not required to have pole attachment contracts with the pole owners to attach their facilities to the poles. It becomes unfair and unreasonable in resolving pole attachment disputes to apply these regulations only to one of the parties in a dispute. The commission is burdened by the inequity of such cases, and the proposed change will help the commission equitably apply the state's rules across the board. This redefinition will have no impact on public bodies such as municipalities, for instance, who construct communication systems for their own use. Such systems are common in Oregon and are very beneficial to cities in the operation of their internal systems and in communicating with other government bodies. However, when those services are offered to customers or the public, through those publics, who would lose their exemption if there's, what I'm trying to say is if they're offered to the general public, not just government to government. I would note that in the last year, actually last couple of years, we've been working to modify the existing administrative rules, and we've had a good relationship with all of the parties, including the Oregon Joint Use Association, which represents most utilities, the utility association representatives themselves, utility our union leaders, and other interested parties. The expanded definition of licensee is necessary modification to put place to put all parties on the same level playing field. It's not a very complicated issue, but I think it's one of equity in terms of, as my grandmother used to say, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And my sense is the legislature mandated the commission to make sure that everybody plays fair and plays under the same rules, and that's what this bill would do. It would put everybody in the same position who uses the poles and should be compensated for their use. That concludes my formal testimony, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions at this point for Chairman Beyer? Okay. Wish to testify?
No. He's just here for questions.
For comfort and companionship.
Mr. Chair, I just want to have it cleared. Yeah. It means that public bodies will be, if they have a poll, if a public body has a poll, other public utilities could attach to it.
That's currently true.
That's currently true.
And public bodies, as poll owners.
Please identify yourself.
For the record.
Oh, I'm Jerry Murray, utility safety analyst for the PUC. A municipality that owns polls would be subject to these rules, but as an attaching entity, they would not be to, say, another party's polls. I don't know if I made that clear or not.
Under current law.
Yes.
And this will change that.
Yes.
Yes.
This would just apply. Essentially what it is, what it does is it says that anybody attaching to a poll has to enter into, we call it a license, but it's essentially a contract or a lease agreement, if you will, that would specify the terms of attaching to the poll and the financial arrangements that flow from that. It applies across the board. For a municipality, they frankly could do that through their franchise agreement if they wanted to do it that way, or they could do it in a separate agreement. The standard practice generally is that you do a separate contract that says, here's the business terms that we operate under, and then they get a permit for each pole. And the permit really is just one to, when each pole has a diagram and say, this is what the pole is, and here's where the various attachers. On a pole, you may have an electrical utility, a couple of telephone utilities, now maybe a wireless antenna on it, and a cable operator. So you could have a variety of things. And the interest that I think the public has is making sure that that pole is done, or those attachments are done in a safe way, both for the people, the workers who have to work around those poles, and the general public. I think that's the public policy issue.
Any questions at this point? Sir Mars there?
No.
Okay, we may have some later. So if I'm going to ask you to step aside right now and ask that Mr. Don Goddard, Jonathan Dolan, and Richard Gray, who are three people who signed up in opposition. I know I have some more in support, but we're going to play a little teeter potter here to get to the real issues. And I'll let whoever wants to start off first. Go ahead.
Okay, mine will be short. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Don Goddard. I represent the Oregon People's Utility Districts. We have members in Wasco, Columbia, Tillamook, Lincoln, and Lane counties. We provide electricity, and what we'd like to do is briefly explain why we oppose this bill. Under existing law, when we build electric systems, we're required to meet PUC safety requirements, and they come out and inspect us, and we fix any deficiencies. Also, under existing rules, when we put up telecommunications wires on someone else's poles, we're required to get a permit and pay them a fee. Now, it's awkward to do that on a case-by-case basis, so as a matter of practice, our members have contracts with these other pole owners that set the fees and the general terms of connections. What Senate Bill 85 would do is require us to enter into contracts, which we already do, and for that reason we think it's unnecessary. The other thing that Senate Bill 85 would do is make us subject to sanctions by the poll owner. In most cases, those poll owners that we attach to are private corporations, and we think it's inappropriate for the state to give authority to a private corporation to fine a public agency. Most of us who have thought about this can't come up with other examples where that's done. And as the chairman has said, over the last 2 years, we've worked very closely with the PUC and the other poll owners to update the PUC's poll attachment rules, and we think the PUC has done a good job of listening to the concerns of all the participants. But we have seen nothing in that process that justifies or shows a need for this kind of a bill. So for those reasons, we're opposing it. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about our concerns.
Okay. We may have some questions. We'll go to our next testimony here first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Gray. I am a contract administrator with the Portland Office of Transportation, known as PDOT. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear today. I was the city street lighting manager for 10 years, and as a result of this experience, I was appointed by the League of Oregon Cities to represent large cities on the board of the Oregon Joint Use Association, or the OJUA, which you've heard about today. The OJUA is an industry-based nonprofit association dedicated to the education, cooperation, and resolution of utility joint issues. Local governments are both the owners and users of utility poles. The OJUA is charged under state law with advising the PUC on joint use issues, and we've done so in PUC's rulemaking dockets. I provide this information as background for my testimony, but today I'm here representing only the City of Portland's Office of Transportation. Today I'm going to address the city's recommendation on this legislation, provide a brief description of the city's use of pole attachments, and finally point out some concerns we have with the proposal. The City of Portland is not clear what the intent or purpose of this legislation is. In its current form, there are many unanswered questions, and the draft would create statutory ambiguities in the language. And as a result, we had a meeting with the staff of the OPUC last week. We raised a number of questions about the intent, meaning, and definitions contained in this bill. As a result of that discussion, it is our understanding that the staff is working on clarifying the intent of this bill. Once the PUC has clarified the intent and purpose of the bill, we believe we can then have a factual and policy-based discussion. However, until that time, we would ask the committee to direct the interested parties to work out the ambiguities contained in this bill, so that the purpose, intent, and effects are clear. Just to be clear on one point, municipal attachments are already subject to the regulation to protect the public safety. As with all other attachments, to utility poles, the City of Portland's attachments are already subject to oversight by the PUC for compliance with electrical codes and other safety regulations. This bill does not change that. We already comply with NESC. We're required to, and we do. The concerns that we are expressing relate to the extension of the Commission's authority to other aspects, the extension of the Commission's authority to other aspects of the city's usage of utility poles and conduits that are otherwise located on local roads and streets. As drafted, this bill could impact the city in some very dramatic ways. For example, would the bill eliminate our authority to have streetlights, traffic signals, or emergency responder radio repeaters? Just to name a few of the types of attachments that could be impacted by this. Another concern is the fact that Don mentioned that includes the fact that the bill would allow private entities to levy a fine against a public body, a precedent I'm not aware currently exists. We also wonder whether the existing franchises that contain provisions regarding attachments will be considered a contract as required by this change in law, and whether the existing franchise agreements would need to be renegotiated. The city uses pole attachments for a variety of public safety and communication purposes. We have about 4,000 attachments to utility poles, including wires and fiber used to carry video signals, usually for the traffic cameras you see on TV and websites. Traffic signal interconnections so the signals can talk to each other so traffic can move smoothly and safely, and communication between our public safety facilities. We also share these facilities with other governmental entities such as ODOT and TriMet for traffic coordination. The City of Portland also has communications with the Washington County Sheriff, the City of Gresham, and other public agencies. The City of Portland provides these services to other local and state government agencies on a cost recovery basis. Just like mutual aid agreements for fire trucks, there's a long history of this joint cooperation. The city's use of these attachments are also have a historical basis in the old police and fire telegraph system you used to see in boxes downtown Portland. This has long been used in Portland and other cities. The city has several concerns with the intent and language of SB 85. One, cities do not currently pay attachment fees to private utilities. Cities are not currently subject to the private sanction program where the private utilities self-police attachments through the private regime of penalties. The proposed legislation could be read as making the city's licensees for all purposes, including attachment fees and penalties, if the triggering criteria are met. The potential financial impact of attachment fees to Portland could range from about $60,000 a year for the 4,000 attachments to over $1 million a year if the streetlights are included in any expanded definition of attachments. Three, governments are custodians of the right-of-way where poles are located, and it's in the public's interest that we use it efficiently. This means lower costs and avoiding redundant pole installations. Will cities be faced with the choice of installing their own facilities in order to avoid incurring additional costs, creating redundant pole lines throughout the city? Four, government control of the right-of-way is a long-standing tradition and is essential to protect the public's interest. Five, during the last interim between legislative sessions, Quest challenged the authority of the PUC to adopt regulations for utility attachments. The Oregon Court of Appeals upheld that the commission could rationally and legitimately distinguish between private entities and public bodies and how regulations are enforced. The Oregon Supreme Court denied review on November 21st, 2006. In other words, it is unclear to the city why the regulatory scheme must now be revamped after ongoing judicial scrutiny and being upheld by Oregon courts in all the particulars. Six, defying governments with licensees exposes them to sanctions by poll owners, setting up private parties to be in a position to fine the public, draining public resources. As was noted by the Oregon Court of Appeals, the existing legislation distinguishes between public and private entities. It is plausible to assume that government entities are generally acting in the public interest. No one has identified how the existing enforcement scheme is failing or why it must be modified as proposed. So many governments have facilities attachment agreements or franchises that govern poll action, poll attachments. This is a solution in search of a problem. We are required to comply with electric safety codes, as I indicated before. In the recent PUC Division 28 rulemaking, the OJUA considered including government entities as licensees and rejected the idea. The OJUA also reviewed this idea when it was in a similar draft legislative concept and opposed it then. The language is vague in several cases. What is the meaning of electricity? Would it be a street light or a traffic signal, for example? What is the meaning of communication service? Could it mean our radio repeaters or the integrated regional network enterprise where we share that with the other agencies? See, what is the meaning of customers or members of the public? Does that include other public bodies? D, it applies to attachments that are considered for the purpose of providing electricity or communication services to customers or members of the public. If the city shares information with TriMet and shares costs with TriMet, then is TriMet a customer of the city's? Is the conclusion changed if the information is gathered for the city's own use and then passed along to TriMet for its purposes? It's not clear whether the presence of a single attachment that fits the definition acts as a trigger that lumps all city attachments into the category. If a city has telecommunications equipment, for example, to monitor traffic patterns and alter the timing sequences of signals feeding traffic onto highway on-ramps, does this then mean that all city attachments are then subject to utility attachment fees and possible sanctions? The bill should make clear that traffic signal span wires, the wires that hold up signals, and streetlights are not considered as attachments. It's unclear whether a franchise agreement that includes terms for attachments is sufficient to serve as the agreement required of licensees. And what happens if a utility refuses to agree with franchise? We hope the PUC will clarify the intent of this bill. Its impacts could be far-reaching and have the potential of having very serious consequences that we are confident were never intended. The city's use of poll attachments is essential to preserving public safety and efficient government. Cities understand that our use of these facilities in the public right-of-way needs to be coordinated with poll owners, and we have tried to do that as responsibly as we can through direct communication, franchise negotiation, and participation in the OJUA. Cities are more than willing to be at the table to work through the issue. The vague language in this bill doesn't solve any problems and merely creates more. Thank you for the opportunity to address this topic. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, before we do that, we'll go to one more piece of testimony, and I'm sure as Chairman Byer knows, I'll be asking him to come up next to respond to some of the things we've been making notes about. So go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Dolan. I'm the Associate Director of Network Services for Oregon State University, and I'm here representing the Oregon University System. I come to before you today with concerns over the current bill. I haven't necessarily had as much time to do the in-depth review that my colleagues have here, but in particular, we're concerned over the language that this bill purports to regulate the attachment of poles to government bodies when they have the purpose of providing electricity or communication services to customers or the members of the public. This terminology isn't as clear to me, at least, as it was to the chairman when he produced it. He said that in his testimony earlier that the intention was not to affect municipal or government use of the poles for their own purposes, and only when they cross the line into providing it to customers or the members of the public would they be regulated. It's been my experience that the purpose for the original construction, specifically for communications infrastructure, doesn't always stay the same, and parts of there may be multiple purposes with that construction in the first place. To put this in context, let me explain my experience with pole attachments. In my capacity with Oregon State University, I conducted a project starting in 2002 to construct fiber optic cable from Corvallis to Albany. I did this to increase the Internet and Internet 2 connectivity for Oregon State University, but I also had to find ways to pay for it in creative ways, and we worked with a private partner that was a nonprofit at the time to construct the fiber, to be able to do pole attachments and connect out to other regional consortia fiber within the higher ed system. That process took 2 years, and a vast majority of that was specifically trying to sort out the pole attachment agreements with the utilities involved. I understand that there are issues with poles and that we need to keep safety in mind when we deal with the poles. My concern is the ambiguity over whether or not there is a regulatory authority and who has the last say when we're constructing this. As a public entity, it's not always clear to me then if I have a problem with the utility that I'm attaching to, do I have to try to explain whether or not I think the appropriate regulatory body is the PUC or not, and then do I have to get into this debate about the purpose of the construction versus the fact that I have it? The attachment's the same. When I attach to a pole, whether I'm using it for my own purposes or I'm serving a customer, whatever that means, in my context, it's not as clear to me what a customer is than when it isn't. So, in short, my issue here is that we respectfully request that you clarify the language. Either regulate public bodies or don't. This feels like it's sort of half in and half out, and it's going to make it more confusing to sort out pole attachment agreements than less, and I appreciate the time listening to me today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel this time?
I guess one.
Yeah, Senator Starr.
In your agreements with the utilities to whom who owns the poles you're attaching your cable to or your wire to, you pay them a fee, a license fee or a rental fee to use that pole attachment currently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, speaking specifically on my experience, and I can't speak for every government body out there, the pole attachment agreement that regulates Oregon State University's attachment to poles was, in fact, negotiated with our private partner, and there is a fee paid by the private partner for the attachment. We had to fulfill all of the safety regulations and, in fact, complied with PUC regulations since it was done with our partner. It is, however, an owned facility by Oregon State University, and if for some reason our agreement with our partner were to dissolve, I would be responsible directly for the attachment, and I don't have a pole attachment agreement with them currently.
The City of Portland does not pay any fees now. Our franchise agreements are negotiated bilaterally with the parties state that we get free access to the poles, but that we also have to comply with all the safety regulations.
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the PUDs, yes, we pay a fee for our pole attachments.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. You can go ahead and step aside for the time being. I'd like to have Chairman Beyer come up next, so that as we have some of these issues start coming on the table, we can start dealing with them rather than be repetitive. I made a note of a number of them. I'm sure you did as well. So I think maybe the first, you know, part, Mr. Chairman, is the question that is through the intent of the bill. Maybe you might, first of all, address that question. There seems to be some question as to what the PUC is actually trying to get at here, and maybe you could clarify that one first.
The intent, as I said when I first spoke, was to require all parties who attach to a pole, when they're doing so, I'll say it this way, as a business, their intent is to sell a service to a retail customer, that they would have to enter into contract. It does not specify what that contract would contain or the terms. It just specifies that there would be one. As I said, a contract, for example, for a municipality could be part of their franchise agreement. So that's the intent. The confusion over some of the language currently, the rules and the processes do not generally cover things like street lights or communications. You know, some cities have put up wireless systems around their city for their own use. Doesn't cover that. Question about whether it should or not, but it doesn't cover that. That's not the intent.
What about Mr. Dolan's point, like with Oregon State, it was the fiber optic attachments that were made. It was unclear as to whether that would be governed by the PUC or not. I mean, explain how something like that would be.
I'm not familiar with Mr. Dolan's arrangement. He said he did it with private partners, so I'm not sure what that is. It sounds like his private partners entered into attachment agreements with whoever the pole owner was. That's what it sounds like, but I'm not sure. And in turn then, in some way, subcontracted with Oregon State to do the others. But to be clear, if Oregon State, for example, is running a fiber line from Corvallis to some campus office they had in Albany for their own use under legislation, it would not cover that.
Okay, and then one other question about Senator Starr is that Mr. Gray was pointing out that in the way the city of Portland looked at it, a lot of agreements, historical agreements they have, again, felt there was some ambiguity there as to whether those historical agreements would suddenly now be fall under this type of regulation, even to the extent of using television cameras and other attachments, and was unclear as to whether or not this might fall under a new level of regulation by the PUC.
I think the test, again, was, are they using whatever that attachment is to sell a service to the general public? And as Mr. Gray described, I think the answer to that would be no. The second part of that one would be, again, all this would do is say you have to have a contract. And it sounded like the city of Portland has that through their franchise agreement. So they are probably in compliance.
Okay, then one other thing, and I'll go to the other questions, is so maybe you could articulate for the committee, just highlight a particular example of which this legislation would address that the PUC has had to deal with and found an important need to bring this forward in order to solve that.
Can you give us sure, Mr. Chair. The best example is the one I alluded to, and it's the case that was in front of us, Central Lincoln PUD versus Verizon. In that situation, both entities were attaching to each other's poles. In many cases, when they did an audit, in both sides, there were what's called unauthorized attachments. In other words, they're attachments made without a permit in charge. Central Lincoln filed charges against Verizon, if you will. For various reasons, those were dismissed more on procedural grounds, and Verizon went the other way. And it's a question about, and I think it's fairness. Should there be a standard contract that they both entered into that would cover that, that would specify how you get a permit and what has to be on that and what the conditions of attachment are and how much you're going to pay for that? Keep in mind, these poles are like private, well, not, they aren't not like private, they are private property, and there's a value to them, there's a cost to maintaining them, and there's safety issues. And all this bill is trying to get at is to make sure that everybody addresses the context in the same way.
And then one final question I wanted to ask, because a couple of people did bring this up about feeling that it was inappropriate and without precedence that you would be setting up the potential for private entities to take action against, public entities, and providing the role of government as a private entity to find or otherwise take action. Your reaction to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is an issue. The legislature, I believe it was in the 99th session, out of frustration, primarily most of these issues have been brought forward by the cable companies in the past, how they attach. And the resolution was, well, to make sure that everybody plays by the game and gets these contracts in place, they put a sanctioning rule in place, or a sanctioning requirement in place. Essentially, it says, if you don't have a contract, if you don't get the permits, as a way to make the party, regardless of who, you can be sanctioned. Now, the fact of the matter is, and I think Mr. Gray mentioned that we just had a case filed by Quest, challenging the state's authority to allow that sanctioning to go forth. And the court said that was okay. Here's the reality around that, though. You only pay the sanctions voluntarily to the private entity. If, for example, you're the city of Portland and I'm Quest and I say you violated and want to sanction you, I can do that. But your response is one you can say, okay, I'm just going to pay this and get it off my you know, get it off my plate, not have to deal with it. Or you appeal to the Public Utility Commission. In the case of the appeal, who sanctioned you then is going to be the State of Oregon through the Public Utility Commission. That's the way it's going to work out. Unless it's done voluntarily, they say, you're right, I should have, and I didn't, and I'll pay the fee.
Which is essentially, if you feel it's an unjust claim, you go to the PUC and have
That's right. And the due process is fairly lengthy.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm having a little hard time figuring out why exactly this bill is necessary, because it sounds like to me the testimony that we've had from the public side is that they all have already entered into these contracts. They already do this. They already pay a fee if they're providing a service. They have a contract already. I guess the only thing that the nut here that I think is what the chair just talked about is the ability to sanction. Is that really what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I gave you a case where that wasn't the situation. Central Lincoln PUD. We went through that. We litigated it. That wasn't the case there. There have been complaints that we have received by owners, private owners of poles on this, which is why it's here. It came up through all of the discussions. I will tell you that in most cases, it's working. But there are some that it's not. What this gets at is in terms of the authority of the state government through the PUC in order to try and fulfill the directive that you've given to the PCU to make sure that people play fair on the polls. And we don't have the authority now to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, you can step aside. And we've had the proponents and some opponents, and so now we're going to go back to the proponents. So Renee, looks like Willer, Brent Wolf, and Doug Cooley. Three of you would like to come forward. We normally have three chairs there, but, you know, I just...
We can
the new friend. But we're going to do two of you at a time and then third one. And yeah. Yeah, Mr. Dewey signed up, but he didn't tell us where he stands on this. So... Ladies first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Renee Willer, and I represent Verizon Northwest, which is a telecommunications utility serving customers in Washington County, Yamhill County, Clackamas County, East Multnomah, and the South Oregon coast and Eastern Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 85, which, if passed, would bring people's utility districts and municipal utilities under the Public Utility of Oregon's pole attachment regulations. Verizon is a pole owner in the state of Oregon, and we also attach to other entities' poles in order to provide service to our customers. Our 35,000 poles are available to other entities to attach to as well, and we enter into contracts with them in order to govern the terms and conditions of attachments and also the rates that the entities apply. And in general, this applies to everybody with the exception of people utilities districts and municipal utilities. The goals of Oregon's pole attachment laws are to provide non-discriminatory access to essential facilities and to ensure that the rates, terms, and conditions for attachments are just, reasonable, and non-discriminatory. If this bill passes, it ensures that all entities providing electric or communication services in Oregon are subject to the same legal and regulatory requirements within the state of Oregon governing their attachments to poles. This bill requires the public bodies to enter into contracts, and the terms and conditions under which the attachments are made will be clearly described for both owners and the public bodies. Chairman Beyer mentioned a case between Verizon Northwest and Central Lincoln PUD. There was a attachment contract that came out of that case. And to this date, Central Lincoln has not signed that contract. So you can see where this is of concern to Verizon. For the most part, everything works okay between the utilities and the PUDs and municipal electrics. But this just provides, the passage of this bill would provide certainty for all the parties involved by having, requiring an agreement that each party signs that governs the terms and conditions of the attachments. So to summarize, I urge you to pass the bill because it provides a level playing field for all entities that are attached to poles in Oregon. It ensures that the current PUC attachment rules are applied fairly and equitably, and it does provide regulatory certainty by making the attachment rules apply to all entities that are attached to poles in Oregon.
Thank you, Ms. Willer. So you make the point about uniformity. I was curious if hearing some of the previous testimony in opposition to the bill, if you had any comment on any of the points that were made or to enlighten us on any of those points from your point of view.
Well, in regards to the sanction, the purpose of the sanctions, as Chairman Beyer spoke about, were to cover companies that make unauthorized attachments or fail to take timely corrective action to correct safety violations. Currently, the PUDs and the municipal utilities are allowed to sanction utilities such as Verizon or CenturyTel for lack of authorized attachments or failure to correct certain situations, and it seems that it would be only fair to make it a level playing field and to make the same rules apply to public entities that are attached to our poles.
Yeah. Thank you. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Doug Cooley. I work for CenturyTel. CenturyTel is a telephone company, much like Verizon or Quest. We serve largely rural areas in Oregon. We're sprinkled in 55 communities around the state, from Durkee to Depot Bay and from Boardman to Bonanza, as we say. Mm-hmm. And I just had a few brief statements. I don't have any written comments, but CenturyTel does support Senate Bill 85. The concept of fairness, I think, is the prevailing point. And I believe, to speak to some of the points that were mentioned earlier, with your permission, Mr. Chair, is we do believe that there are plenty of safety rules and regulations that all the entities must follow. CenturyTel is a pole attacher as well as a pole owner in this state, much like Verizon and some of the other entities. And we simply believe that when there are opportunities for, public entities, government entities to sanction CenturyTel for violations of certain conditions, that it makes sense, if that's the incentive that is necessary, then that same incentive, and it's the same reasoning, applies for CenturyTel when entities apply or attach to our poll, whatever that entity might be. I guess another alternative solution would be that if the NESC safety code or the rules and regulations that address these things, which CenturyTel abides by, much like the PUDs and everybody else, if that were enough, then CenturyTel would certainly support removing all sanctioning authority. I mean, if it's not going to work both ways, if it's not an effective tool for all entities, then maybe it's not an effective tool at all. In my mind, that's the reasoning in that CenturyTel's comments. But I'm available for any questions if you have any.
Thank you. I'll ask you the same question as Ms. Willer. Do you have any comments on any of the points that were brought up by the opponents of the bill pertaining to your company or enlightenment on any of those issues?
No, Mr. Chair, nothing that would be in addition to what I've already stated.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee of our two witnesses here? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I don't want to belabor any of the points that have already been made. I just wanted to go on the record of stating that we do support the commission in this effort. The one thing that I would indicate, maybe just to try and be a little different than everybody else, is that this just isn't solely attachment, but the way you attach as well. And if there's an unauthorized attachment that violates the rules that we all play by, then that can make everybody else on the pole in violation of the rules as well. I mean, what one person does affects everybody on the pole. And having licensing agreements in place with everybody just makes it that much easier to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think the sanctioning part of this whole effort shouldn't be ignored either, or it should be recognized. Sanctions definitely compel a party, an entity, to do things the right way because it's painful. And if we can be sanctioned for attaching inappropriately to a public utility or a public entity's poles, then the reverse ought to be true as well. It's fair, it's equitable, and we support the effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Any questions for Mr. Wolf?
Just one. You heard the testimony from Mr. Gray from the City of Portland.
I'm sorry?
Did you hear the testimony from Mr. Gray from the City of Portland?
I believe I did. I had to step out for a minute, but I'm sure I can catch up.
Well, I won't go through, but he listed a number of questions that he had related to the bill. Do you have any response to any of those questions? I mean...
Well, I think I would like, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think I'd like to look at those a little more closely, or maybe you could ask me one in particular I might be able to address.
Well, I guess the question is, it's about whether the bill is overall is clear enough about customers and who they are, and that I think piece of the bill I think is the one that might need more clarification, at least as it relates to the comments from Mr. Gray.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think if there's some clarification that's needed, I'm sure we could work towards that effort. I wouldn't want the bill to be looked upon unfavorably just on the clarification matter. I think that the principle of the point is that it's a fairness issue, and that's why we're here. That's why we support the effort, and we're happy to work on anything that needs to be clarified.
Great, thank you.
Any questions? Okay, our last two signed up testimonies, Andrea Fogue and Mike Dewey. Andrea didn't tell us where she is on the bill, but we're going to find out. And we'll
let
you start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities. And that's because we're a little bit confused by this bill. We have some unanswered questions. It's really great to hear a chairman of the PUC buyer state some of the intent. We're just not sure at this point that the language matches that intent. Last week we sat down with the AG for the Public Utility Commission and some of their staff and started talking through some of these issues. And so we're confident we can at least come to language where the intent matches the language, and then we need to really take a look at it from a full policy perspective. But at this point, to address some of the things that you've heard today, local government, you're not going to hear us argue about a level playing field. You're also certainly not going to hear us say that we don't want to meet every safety regulation. And, of course, that's something that the PUC regulates very, very closely right now. So as we see this bill, it would be the piece about permitting and contracting, and then, as Senator Starr pointed out, the sanctions. And all of that seems reasonable in terms of the contract and permitting and all the communication needs to happen to know what's going on with a particular pole. We are, however, not clear about the sanctioning piece, because certainly we wouldn't want to absolve ourselves from any responsibility for a safety issue or something done incorrectly on the pole. Mm-hmm. However, I've heard Chairman Beyer say that that authority lies with the PUC, and from our perspective at this point, we're just not clear what that process would be. We are uncomfortable with a precedent that would allow a private entity to sanction a governmental entity. Now, we think that authority lies with the Public Utility Commission, and they are the appropriate entity to be looking at those situations. And so from our perspective, we'd like to know a little bit more about what the process would be to ensure that it is indeed the Public Utility Commission that's resolving any issues with an appeal with an alleged violation on a pole. And with that, we've, as I said, begun those conversations with the Public Utility Commission and their staff, and we'd really like to continue to explore that and participate in any process to make sure that the language of this bill matches the intent.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and go with Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, members of the committee representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I apologize. I believe your administrator, and I thank her for signing me in on this bill. I had had a previous engagement. I was not sure I was going to be back. You do have some written testimony. I'm not going to read that because I don't have it in front of me. But I will.
Would you like a copy of your testimony?
It's not particularly memorable.
I knew it wasn't memorable. But we do support the legislation, and if we need to clarify some of the issues, we're very happy to. It is a matter, and I hate to use the word level playing field. We have a very unique statute, and I've dealt with this issue for, unfortunately, 34 years. I think we're getting it right, depending on what the PUC does with a new rule that we may see, hopefully, in the near term, AR 506 and 510. We have issues with sanctions. My client has paid a lot of money in sanctions. In some cases, it was correct. In other cases, it has not been. But nonetheless, to get moving on, we've done that. We understand the Supreme Court decided not to hear the Quest case. Our concern is if a municipality, public body, gets into the businesses that we are in and have a different set of rules. We're sanctioned. They're not for their practices. That's not fair. I'm talking about being in the in Ashland. City of Ashland was in the cable business. They lost $15 million, and so they've leased out that part of the facility, but they're in the Internet business competing with Quest and Charter Communications. So if they have a different set of rules and regulations, and we're competing, that isn't fair. City of Monmouth Independence is now in the telecommunications business at retail. And, you know, I think they're all going to be, good actors and do what's fair for all the parties. Mr. Wolf is right. If you start making incorrect installations, it impacts everybody else on the pole, and in doing so, that's an additional cost. And we think we need to have some incentives to make sure that this occurs. So we're happy to sit down with the cities, but we think this is an issue that needs to be resolved. So that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee on either of these two individuals? Okay, thank you. What we're going to do, we've heard a couple of things here today that's been repetitive. Number one is making sure everybody's playing by the same rules or level playing field. I do hate that phrase. I think I want to outlaw it. But anyway, we heard universal thought that this is important. No one says they want to play by different rules. There was a question by a number of folks about ambiguity in terms of, you know, what's applied under this, and do we really understand what the intent is, and does the language reflect that? There was a couple of people that brought that up and reinforced that, and certainly we wouldn't want to put anything that's in a statute that was unambiguous. And third, there was a question that I thought a number of people referred to, which was making sure that there was not some unusual situation where you had private entities levying regulation or fine on others. And I think the take I got from the PUC, from Chairman Beyer, was that really wasn't the case. The case was to help streamline the process. You have to go through a long appearance through the PUC if, in fact, you're wrong. And if you think that someone's unfairly asking you for compensation, then you can go to the PUC and then go ahead and go through that process, but at the end of the day it would be the PUC's ruling. I mean, that's just my synopsis of some of the key points I heard today. It would be my intention that we will be moving this forward. So what I would like to do is, and with the comments that were made today, which were very valuable and important, is to work with Janet on those issues of ambiguity and to make sure that we have clarification on that, and then we will bring the bill back in a couple of weeks with that. Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing. Excuse me. Oh, yes. Go ahead, Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom O'Connor from the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities was unable to come today, and I have he's opposed to the bill, and it's just going to indicate that, and I'll pass that up.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you very much. So with that, we're going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 85 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 86. We can get moving here. We'll ask Chairman Beyer to come forward. And I have two other people signed up on this, and we'll be out on time today. Our first full day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. Hopefully this was a little easier. Once again, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, here to speak today on Senate Bill 86. What Senate Bill 86 does is it clarifies the PUC's authority to resolve consumer complaints as they relate to charges placed on customers' telephone bills without their consent and sometimes without receiving the goods or services. And this process is commonly referred to in the industry as cramming. You might recall that in the last session we dealt with slamming, which is unauthorized changing of long-distance carriers. This is the other side of that issue. Frankly, this is something that the PUC has been doing within what we thought was our general authority for decades. Recently, however, our legal counsel from the AG's office advised that she thought we should seek specific legislative authorization so that there would be no question about the Commission's establishment of standards and requirements for acquiring consumer authorization on purchase of services. Again, we think that this probably falls within our general authority, but there are some questions, so we're bringing our standard practice back in front of me again. I want to be clear that it's not the intention of the Commission to change anything that we have been doing for years to protect consumers, and this bill does not add anything new to that practice. I know there's been some concern expressed by members of the wireless industry that this would impact them. While I might want to go there, this bill doesn't do that. At least it's not our intent. The intent is merely to clarify the Commission's authority as it relates to providers of wireline, say it again, wireline telecommunications services. That's what we're talking about here. So that, Mr. Chair, simple bill. We'll see how much trouble I can get into on this one.
Okay, thank you. Any initial questions for Chairman Beyer?
Just one.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm unclear on why we distinguish so much between wireline and wireless. I understand the historical nature of incumbent carriers and non-incumbent, but it seems to me more and more in so many ways that line is blurred every day. It just becomes more blurred.
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, I'm unclear about that, too. But I guess the real reason is because the laws that we have in effect were written for an industry as it used to exist, not as it exists today. And in order to protect an evolution of competition by other technologies, Congress and in their wisdom and the FCC has provided some exclusions for that, specifically to wireless, which I think you're asking. Cellular, as we may know, cell traffic is specifically exempted in Oregon by definition. Our definitions and statutes, when we define what telecommunication is, it specifically excludes radio communications, which is cellular. Nationally, the feds through the FCC have excluded state regulation, that's you, not necessarily us, but you, from touching cellular except in terms of competition, in terms of prices. The only thing that they've left you with is what's called, in terms of it's contract law, it's terms and conditions. You can't set the price, but you could deal with that, and to some extent with we have some agreements in dealing with customer protections on that, but not. It's pretty sketchy. The other emerging technology is voice over the internet protocol, and that's going to take various forms, including the one that you probably are more familiar with in Oregon through Comcast, which is it's telephony over cable systems. That right now is outside, and that one on the federal level, the Congress and the FCC keeps changing their minds, as have the court, so it's a little bit unclear on that. But that's the history on that. I don't know if that helps. To me, when I hear from customers, it's all telephone to them. Uh-huh. They don't see the distinction.
Thank you. Any questions for Chairman Beyer? Thank you. Let's ask Ginny Lang and John Powell to please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest, and I appreciate the opportunity to just raise a couple of questions. The first one is I'm a little confused as to what has transpired or occurred that makes the Public Utility Commission or the Attorney General believe that legislation is necessary to continue doing what, as Chairman Beyer suggests, they've been doing with wireline companies for a lot of years. And the second thing I would want to raise is that I think that some of the language is a little overbroad, and I would hope that if the intention of the committee is to move this, that we would have some time to talk with Chairman Beyer and staff about some of these things. For example, in Section 2, Sub B, Lines 16, 17, 18, where it refers to telecommunication services or other goods and services, I would certainly hope that that the Public Utility Commission's role would be confined to telecommunications kinds of products or services. I have no idea what companies might be offering along with telecom services in a package or a bundle, but if, for example, a company offered a handset of some kind, a piece of hardware that is not under the purview of the commission, would their authority spread to that? Or if there were other kinds of services that were part of this offering? And I guess the last thing I would say is I'm not sure I understand the way that the bill is constructed, because it's all May that if the commission decides they want to do this, they may do this or they may do that. It just seems kind of wishy-washy to me. I don't understand the construction of the bill, and I guess I'd go back to my first point, is I really don't understand what's occurred that has promoted the need to add yet more legislation to the commission's ability to take care of customer complaints. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and go to Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing AT&T. Mr. Chairman, I'm before you with many of the same issues that Ms. Lang just pointed out to you. It is not clear to us that there is a limitation in this bill, the way it is constructed and worded. If you look at the definitional section that's referred to in the last lines of Senate Bill 86, on lines 26 and 27, it refers to the definition of retail communications service and telecommunications carrier as those terms are defined in ORS 759-400. 759-400 has a very general definition of those terms. It does not exclude cellular or VoIP or any other form of telecommunications. So while we do not dispute the intent of the commission to authorize them to do what they're currently doing, we do think that this bill needs some work in terms of actually saying that. So with that, I'd be glad to go into any more detail on our concerns on those, if the committee would wish, but otherwise we would work with others.
Okay. My first question for both or either one of you would be back to what the chairman pointed out in his introductory testimony, was that, to paraphrase what he said, was it wasn't the intent of the commission to do anything differently or to provide any oversight that's different than what they currently are, but rather under advice of counsel to make it very clear about those authorities. And I hope I gave a general interpretation of that. With that as the intent, I would just be curious as to either of your opinions on that, as the objective is to basically put into law for comfort the status quo, and if the status quo and how things are interpreted before we get into whether these things do that or not, if that is satisfactory to your client, to the people you represent.
Mr. Chairman, Jenny Lang, for the record. I guess I'm not in favor of adding stuff to the statutes just for the for sake of comfort. If the process has been working and customers are being served the way that it is operating today, I'm just not for adding a lot more verbiage to the statutes.
I understand that. I appreciate that. I don't think I may have asked my question well. But the way in which the PUC does currently operate in this particular realm, has that met with satisfaction in terms of their authority and how they've exercised what they believe is their authority?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And as a traditional wireline incumbent local exchange carrier, which is certainly under the purview of the PUC, we do not have any trouble with the way that they have been taking care of cramming issues with our company and our customers.
Right. Mr. Chairman, John Powell with AT&T, and again, we would have the same position. We would like to know what has changed the AG's mind in this regard. And I would also add that the bill that Commissioner Beyer referred to that actually passed in 2003, time has gone faster than he thinks so. I think he said 2005, on slamming, does indeed carry with it an exception for radio common carriers, which is cell phones. So that it, when that statute was adopted, it was seen fit to add that exclusion into that body of law. I think it's even more relevant to the bill in front of you if indeed the intent is to do what they're currently doing. Again, we would like to know a little bit more about the opinion and what's changed, and if indeed it is to do what they're currently doing to assist in drafting language, that comfort language, as you might say, with mashed potatoes and gravy.
Adding a whole plate there. any questions for our two guests? Thank you.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Well,
oh, Claire Myers Anderson.
Yes, thank you. Just real quick. When they say they really want to establish standards and requirements for telecommunication carriers to obtain consumer authorization for charges for telecommunications, why wouldn't you want at least a clarification, at least that piece of legislation, so that they had guidelines on how to treat the complaints that come in?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monday,
there may not be complaints.
There are rules and statutes currently that govern what we think their authority is, and as the commissioner testified, they thought they had this authority up to this point. But they have had, there are methodologies in dealing with these. I might also point out that while Elise Brown represents the AT&T/Singular part of our business, that most of the major cell operators have signed an agreement with the state of Oregon on conduct and those sorts of things. So if you include the federal government on down, there's lots of rules and regulations on dealing with these issues. And I think that's why the Quest representative here said just adding stuff does not necessarily clarify how
thank
we
you.
Operate.
Appreciate it.
Any more questions? Okay, thank you. Before we close for the day, those are the only ones that had testified at this time in this bill. Chairman Beyer, do you have any response, or any of the people from your agency would like to respond to any of the questions in terms of, I think the primary one was, why is the agency's now discomforted with the current language or lack thereof, and maybe you might provide some enlightenment on that before we close for the day?
Mr. Chairman, if I could enlighten anything the attorneys do, I would try, but
I can appreciate
it. The language, let me just be very clear. Mm-hmm. As I said before, the reason we're here is because the AG said it would be better to have it clarified in law so that attorneys like to have very clear direction from the legislature on what agencies have the authority to do or not. The standards issues that were there, we have for the wireline carriers, we have administrative rules, have had for many years that deal with most of that. This is just getting back at the authority to do that in case it's challenged, I guess. In terms of the language of the bill, hey, they're your legislative counsel.
Well, I think this was requested of the governor, so I think it came through the attorney general was writing this one.
No. Mr. Chair, they all come through legislative
counsel. They wrote it on their own. Okay.
No, we asked them. We would be happy to meet with people and clarify that.
Well, one final thing I'd ask you was the point that was brought up on the final two lines of the bill, 2627, referring to the definitions that would be applicable to this bill from ORS 759.400, and the indication that it was a very broad statute and that maybe some of the things that this is not intended to cover, you know, maybe could be interpreted as covering in terms of the wireless category.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I didn't bring that statute with me, so I'm dealing with memory. I think if it's the definitions page at the start, which I think is what they're referring to, I think it fairly clearly exempts radio communications. There's a link in there.
Mr. Chair, I just looked it up.
Maybe you have to go back to the other one, the definition.
I just looked it up, Mr. Chair, and it looks pretty broad to me.
Yeah. I think what we'll do here is we're having a public hearing today, and I know that kind of puts Chairman Beyer on the spot without all the great attorneys that tell you to do things, and they disappear when you need them, right? You know, to tell us why it happened. And what I think we'll do at this point is, again, I would ask Chairman Beyer for your staff to get together with some of this, the folks that you regularly work with who have these issues and see if there can be at least some understanding of what the agency is trying to do and as well as maybe get some present some clarification as well as in terms of why you feel this is important. And we'll bring this back in a while. But
we'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Get some time to do that.
I just want to be very clear. One of the values that I brought to the commission is anything we do something, we do it very transparently and we do it in advance. Everybody's had a chance to see this particular draft for months.
Yeah.
So there are no surprises here, but we're happy to work with everybody.
And I appreciate it. I understand that. So now we've had a chance to bring them out in a public forum. Maybe we can bring them together a little sooner. That's it. Janet, anything about tomorrow you want us to know? Or Wednesday?
No, Mr. Chair. We have interesting bills on chimney cleaning and well drilling.
Chim, chim, shree. Okay. We'll close for the day.